This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we all are hopeful that we shall all be able to pull out of Somalia in the shortest possible time, that we will be able to work together with the federal government of Somalia to be able to strengthen them, that they are able to take care of the security concerns within their own country.
That's Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta speaking on Al-Shabaab and regional security during his recent trip to Washington. Details next.
Also, the U.S. military today said its forces carried out an airstrike in Somalia that killed three Al-Shabaab fighters. And the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights is expressing deep concern about growing unrest and violence in Uganda.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Today, five Kenyan soldiers died when a roadside bomb blew up their vehicle near the border with Somalia. Several others were injured. Although military authorities have not said who carried out the attack, similar attacks in the border region have been blamed on Al-Shabaab extremists crossing from Somalia. Earlier this week, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta was in Washington. He met with President Donald Trump, and among other things, they discussed regional security, including Somalia. While in Washington, Kenyatta sat down with VOA's Esther Gitui Ewart for an exclusive interview. In our final portion of their talk, he discusses Kenya's role in stabilizing Somalia.
Mr. President, with regards to Somalia, you had to deal with Al-Shabaab militants having attacked Kenya, decimating people, creating a lot of chaos. And there have been some calls within your Kenyan legislators asking that you pull out of Somalia. Is that something that is likely to happen? How is the war against terrorism going on?
Well, like I said, this is even some of the issues that we will be discussing with our American counterparts. We all are hopeful that we shall all be able to pull out of Somalia in the shortest possible time, that we will be able to work together with the federal government of Somalia to be able to strengthen them, that they are able to take care of the security concerns within their own country, and so that we can pull back to our borders and reduce that cost that we are currently bearing and be able to focus that on other more productive areas. So we would be hopeful, and we are constantly encouraging and working with our Somali counterparts, with the AU under the AMISOM umbrella, because Kenya is not the only country that has troops there, working together with various other organizations to help our Somali brothers and sisters to come together and to be able to focus on their own country, bring them together, and eliminate this threat that is a threat not just to Kenya, but is also a threat to the Somali people themselves. So until we are in such a situation, it is impossible for us to say when or the withdrawal date shall be this. The withdrawal date is based on us being able to defeat Al-Shabaab, on the Somali people being able to establish strong, solid security structures, a national army, and good administrative structures that will then ensure that they are capable of handling their own affairs. I think that should be the focus, as opposed to when people withdraw, because we can't say we are going to withdraw and leave a vacuum. There must be something to replace that vacuum. And a withdrawal date should be tied towards a scenario where the people of Somalia have themselves been able to establish and to take care of the security concerns in their country, as well as the administrative foundations that they shall need to build a strong and stable Somalia.
I'm wondering, Mr. President, this is your second and last term as President of Kenya. How do you want your legacy to be written?
I want my legacy to be one of bringing our nation and our people together, a nation that will have confidence in its institutions, a nation that would have left corruption and the issues of nepotism and other things that have been a destructive element to our country. I wish to be able to leave Kenya on a foundation that is better and irreversible, and where Kenyans and the international community can have confidence, not in the individual who leads, but in the institutions that we shall create.
That was Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta speaking with VOA's Esther Gitui Ewart.
The U.S. military today said its forces carried out an airstrike in Somalia that killed three Al-Shabaab fighters. The U.S. Africa Command said the attack took place Monday, about 40 kilometers southwest of Mogadishu, in cooperation with the Somali army. The U.S. is one of several nations, including Kenya, that are supporting the Mogadishu government as it battles Al-Shabaab, an Islamic militant organization linked to Al-Qaeda.
Schools in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon are preparing to reopen for the first time in 2 years. Armed separatists who forced the majority of schools to close now say they can resume instruction. The separatists, however, say they cannot guarantee teachers and students will be safe. Moki Edwin Kinzigo reports from Batibo in northwestern Cameroon.
With Cameroon's school year set to resume on September 3, a group of students and their parents arrived Wednesday at the government bilingual high school in the northwestern town of Batibu. Deserted for more than a year, the school is in a terrible state, infested with insects and with grass growing through the floor. Hundreds of schools in the area have been abandoned since armed separatists attacked schools and other public buildings 2 years ago. The insurgents, who are fighting for an independent English-speaking state, saw the schools as a legitimate target because they forced the French language on locals. The violence saw thousands of students either move to other school districts or, more commonly, stay at home. 42-year-old Grace Nembo is not deterred. She has come to ensure her 13-year-old son gets an education.
The plight of a mother is to see his or her own child educated so that that child can be edified to be able to face the society and the world at large.
The separatists had demanded schools remain closed until all government troops leave the English-speaking North, West and South West regions. This week, the separatists announced on social media that parents could begin sending their children back to area schools if they wish. However, the message warned the separatists are still fighting Cameroon's military and cannot guarantee school safety. The governor of the Northwest region, Deben Chofo, is trying to assure parents that security measures are in place to protect their children.
I still give firm instruction to the administrative authorities, the security services, to take their responsibility to accompany the resumption of classes.
Peter Nga escaped the fighting in Batibu and says he is not confident his child would be safe there. He will instead send his son to an English school in the French-speaking town of Bafoussam, where there is more security.
I'm ready for my children to go to school, but at the same time, we're a little bit skeptical following the security situation.
The United Nations says more than 200,000 people have been displaced by the violence in Cameroon's English-speaking regions. A majority of them are school-age children. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Batibu, Cameroon.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is expressing deep concern about growing unrest and violence in Uganda. The turmoil was sparked by the recent arrest of pop star turned politician Bobby Wine and 32 opposition politicians. Lisa Schlein reports from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
The arrests on August 13th followed a campaign rally in Uganda's northwestern town of Arua. Charges brought against Bobi Wine and others detained with him range from treason, the illegal possession of firearms, damage to property, and incitement to violence, among others. High Commissioner Zaid Raad Al Hussein says his office has received reports that Bobi Wine's driver was shot dead while sitting in his employer's car. He says he is particularly concerned by reports that law enforcement agents have tortured Wine and some others while in detention. He says his office also has received accounts of killings, ill treatment, and arrest of persons by law enforcement agents during protests against the above-mentioned arrests.
I urge the government of Uganda to conduct a thorough, independent, and impartial investigation into these serious human rights allegations of extrajudicial killings, excessive use of force, torture, and other forms of ill treatment, and to bring to justice those responsible.
The government has not responded to the High Commissioner's remarks, but has denied all allegations of torture, calling them rubbish. Given what has transpired, Zay tells VOA it is absolutely essential the government does the right thing and that there is no further excessive use of force.
Those who have now been detained should be released forthwith, because these charges at the moment, from what we can see, and given the fact that there are credible accounts of torture having been used, wouldn't stack up in any judicial proceeding that meets international standards, of course.
Bobi Wine and the 32 other politicians were granted bail on August 27th. They are expected back in court on Thursday. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now that he has been inaugurated, Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa says his five-year term will focus on development and prosperity. In a country with a battered economy, the success of that effort may depend on who he chooses to run government ministries. Reporter Kutsayi Zvinovashi has the story.
Mnangagwa is set to announce his cabinet ministers soon. Arnold Marufu, a young Zimbabwean, speaks about who he thinks should be among the president's closest advisors.
What we're expecting in the coming cabinet is more of a technocrat-focused cabinet, because we've had scenarios where ministers are continually recycled. But we now want technocrats, the best people who've been trained for those positions.
Marufu says Mnangagwa has done that before when he appointed a tried and tested miner, Winston Chitando, as Minister of Mines. He adds that Mnangagwa should also have youthful and vibrant individuals in the cabinet. Munyara Dzidodo is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament business and political events. It has been running an online poll of people's expectations regarding the cabinet.
A lot of people feel like a real change should be manifested in the cabinet and that the old guard should be released. There's a strong feeling that Obed Mbofu should not come back in this cabinet. Patrick Chinamasa, David Parirenyatwa, Stembiso Nyoni, those are the names that keep coming up.
Dodo adds that the sentiment is that without new faces and personalities in the cabinet, then nothing will have changed in Zimbabwe's politics. Ronnie Kamumbire is the chairperson of Women's Coalition of Zimbabwe and says gender should also be a factor when selecting the cabinet.
As Women's Coalition, we call upon the president to appoint a gender-balanced executive, to appoint women in portfolios of health, finance, education, foreign affairs, defense ministries, to which men have been perennially appointed.
Mumbira says government ought to ensure it promotes women's voices and dignity. Political analyst Rashid Mukundu says the president will have to do away with senior executive posts within the ministries, something that he says has greatly contributed in straining Zimbabwe's fragile economy. Some critics say Mnangagwa will also have to strike a balance between tribal lines. Others say he needs to promote unity, and the best way to do that is by including some opposition members into his cabinet. So far, the president has given few clues as to whom he has in mind to carry out his plans for economic growth and reform. For VOA, this is Kudza Ezinawashe from Harare.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib. 20 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Five Kenyan soldiers died when a roadside bomb blew up their vehicle near the border with Somalia. The U.S. military today said its forces carried out an airstrike in Somalia that killed three Al-Shabaab fighters. And the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights is expressing deep concern about growing unrest and violence in Uganda. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Germany today handed over to Namibia the remains of 27 people killed nearly 100 years ago under imperial rule. Tens of thousands of people, mostly from Namibia's Herero community, died in what has been called the first genocide of the 20th century. The Herero and other ethnic groups had risen up against the German colonialists. In a ceremony at a church in Berlin, German officials handed over 19 skulls, a scalp, and some bones. An official from the German Foreign Ministry asked for forgiveness as she presented the remains to Namibia's culture minister. However, some descendants of the victims are pressing for an official apology from Berlin, which remains engaged in talks with the Windhoek government on a joint declaration on the massacres. They're also asking for reparations for the up to 70,000 Namibians killed. Germany says it has paid hundreds of millions of euros in development aid to Namibia for all of its citizens since the country's independence. A recent undercover investigation conducted by the Humane Society of the United States and the Humane Society International found that giraffe parts and products were being sold online and in stores by at least 51 dealers across the United States. Investigators were told by the sellers that they had purchased the giraffe parts from trophy hunters who promised to continue to supply them with new giraffe products. Some trophy hunters also falsely claimed that giraffes were dangerous and needed to be killed to protect African villages. Adam Payman is manager of programs and operations of the Wildlife Department for the Humane Society International. He spoke with me about the investigation and about what is being done to protect the dwindling giraffe population and to stop the sale of giraffe bones and skins.
The investigation revealed that there were over 50 sellers across the U.S. and various states selling different giraffe products, including knives with giraffe bone handles, giraffe hide products, including skins and rugs, giraffe taxidermy trophies, like a whole animal that was a taxidermy mount, and many other products, including raw bones and more.
And how do these parts actually get into the U.S.? Where does it all start?
What the investigation indicated was that these giraffe products come from trophy hunts of giraffes in Africa. And so usually when an animal such as a giraffe is trophy hunted, the client or the hunter will hire an outfitter who sort of sets up the hunt. And usually the trophy hunter is just interested in a relatively small part of the giraffe, which they want to take home and usually mount on their wall or something. So they'll usually take the head and part of the neck. But that, of course, leaves a large amount of the carcass. And so these outfitters, the investigation revealed, are capitalizing on the rest of this carcass. And, of course, they're plugged into this industry, killing animals and processing their carcasses, whether it be taxidermy or processing the bones, for example, into polished bits that can then be worked into knife handles or pistol grips. And then those are sold in the U.S., so they're imported by dealers principally, but also individuals who went on the trophy hunts then import their trophies And so there's a tremendous amount of giraffe products coming into the United States from Africa.
This type of poaching, how does it compare to the poaching of elephants for their tusk and for rhino horns?
Just to clarify, these hunts of giraffes are seeking their trophies or parts. That is not illegal. And so that's not poaching of giraffes, actually. Although poaching for the bushmeat trade, basically for, you know, usually impoverished people just set snares out to catch whatever they can catch, and that has been recognized as a major threat to giraffes. But that's separate from this industry of trophy hunting and the trade in giraffe parts. Although poaching of elephants and rhinos happens at a more rapid pace.
So at this point, what would be the next step? What can be done to help reduce this, especially since you were looking at different countries in Africa?
Most of the giraffe products and parts that are coming into the U.S. come from South Africa and Zimbabwe. But what we're seeking as a sort of first step to protect the giraffe is regulations on these products that are coming into the U.S. from Africa. And what that's doing, this trade is doing, is putting additional pressure on the species that has suffered a 40% decline in wild populations over the past 30 years. As a first step, we are seeking to have the giraffe listed as endangered under the U.S. Endangered Species Act, and that would restrict in giraffe products coming in or even going out of the U.S. Again, most of these products are coming in.
And looking at the giraffe population, where would it be in a few years from now if this was to continue at this pace?
The wild giraffe populations have lost something like 50,000 individuals since about 1990. So that means that from a total of 150,000, now there are fewer than 100,000. So that's a tremendous decrease over the past three decades or so. So in the next few decades, if that rate continues, giraffes might disappear forever.
Adam Payman is Manager of Programs and Operations of the Wildlife Department for the Humane Society International. He spoke with me from Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Suleiman Terawali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, pressure mounts on Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni over the beating and detention of music star Bobi Wine. And we'll discuss the legacy of Kofi Annan on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa. Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.